Hello, welcome to Faerie and Fantasy Quest number 12. Today we prepare to join Arthur and his knights in wondering just who the heck that huge green guy is. But first, a few words about you catastrophe.
Okay, good morning. So, as I promised at the end of last class, I wanted to start today not by jumping straight into Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, but instead looking back for a moment on the four stories that we've begun with, and especially paying attention to their endings, because there is a trend in their endings that I want to make sure that we draw attention to before we move on, especially before we move on to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Notice that the ends of these stories don't just have happy endings. They do have happy endings, but they don't just have happy endings. There's a particular sort of trend in the happy endings that we can see. Take, for instance, our two loathly weighty stories, right, that we've just finished. Dame Ragnall has a kind of twofold, there's like a two-movement happy ending at the end of that story, right? Movement number one is when Sir Gawain rolls over in bed, right, gritting his teeth, to suddenly find that he is in bed with the most beautiful woman he's ever seen instead of the ugliest, right? That's sort of step one. But it's not done there. He still is now told, yeah, but this isn't necessarily what it seems. At least you're not going to be able to have this full time. And then he has to choose. Of course, then after, he makes his choice. And she says, congratulations, I'm going to be happy full time. And he realizes that that difficult choice, which he gave up on and was too hard for him to decide, he now doesn't have to make at all. And that's sort of the second and final fulfillment of this ending, which is quite, to him, unexpected and happy. The Wife of Bath's Tale, because she doesn't turn beautiful prior to his choice, sort of combines both of those things into one moment. And when he makes his choice, she's still ugly. And so far as he knows, she may remain ugly. In fact, remember, again, an aspect of that we didn't even emphasize, when she gives him the choice, would you have me devastatingly gorgeous or an unfaithful or ugly and faithful? Maybe he's willing to believe her about the moral choice, but the devastating beauty is still entirely theoretical at that time, as is her ability to become entirely beautiful. In fact, one can imagine that he might be in some level of confusion there at the choice itself. What do you mean, have you devastatingly beautiful but unfaithful? You're the ugliest woman I've ever seen. So again, it's an entirely theoretical thing. Anyway, when he makes the choice and she says, cast up the curtain, right? That is, let in some light because they're in a curtained bed. Cast up the curtain and say who it is. That's then this moment of the happy ending and when his heart is bathed in a bath of bliss. And as I said last time, off we go. Now, notice in both of these endings are in some sense a response to the action by the knight. Both halves of Sir Gawain's happy ending come in response to his actions. The first time when he decides, despite my own revulsion, I'm going to turn and do my husbandly duty by you. And the second time when he makes the choice. And of course, our ex-rapist knight, when he does in one swoop make his choice. But at the same time, these happy endings are not simply a reward. Congratulations, you have done well. You are being compensated for your virtue by a happy ending. It doesn't just work like that. Neither one of them have actually earned what they get. Both of them are receiving more than they could possibly have guessed, more even than they're kind of putting themselves in for by their actions. And both of them seem to be, the reactions that we see in both of them and the kind of happiness that we get in their endings, even though, as we saw, Sir Gawain's is short term, nevertheless, it's a kind of happiness that they were never expecting. Sir Gawain was reconciled to being unhappy in his marriage, and he thought that a small price to pay for Arthur's life, but he was willing to do it. Our rapist knight, of course, thought that he himself was now doomed. I don't know whether he thought this was perhaps a fit punishment. He doesn't seem to be thinking in those directions, but anyway, this certainly was beyond his expectations. In Sir Launfal, we get the purest example of this kind of happy ending. Launfal receives a happy ending, which is not merited at all. He's done nothing to deserve it, even if we think the Knights in the Wotherly Waity stories have. He hasn't. In fact, he's demerited it, if anything. He was first given this gift out of nowhere, little muddy, decrepit, abandoned him in the woods, and, you know, Triamor appears to him and takes him in and loves him, and then he blows it, right? He breaks his vow. He violates the prohibition. He deserves never to see her again. And he knows it. He doesn't contest it. When Githra and the horse and the gold and everything are gone and she doesn't come to him when he asks, he knows that he's deserved what he gets. Her appearance, therefore, at the court, her act of generosity and love and humility is really quite breathtaking at the end of that poem. Not only does she forgive his violation of faith, but she herself, in a sense, transgresses exactly the boundary that she commanded him not to transgress. Don't out me to the court, right? Don't talk about me. Don't boast about me. I'm not going to appear in front of everybody. Remember the kind of privacy that fairies all seem to be into so far in the stories that we've seen. You only meet them out in the middle of the woods, usually when you're by yourself. And what we have there at the end of Sir Launfal is Lady Triamore displaying herself to public view. I mean, she, even when she gets off her horse, she like turns around so they can all behold her, right? I mean, she is putting herself out on display. That's, you know, just for his sake, just to save him from execution, or again, sort of ironically, as we described, from banishment. And the reaction to which we are kind of prompted, that is, we see his reaction. His reaction to her when he sees her coming in the distance and recognizes her. His running to follow her. The way in which the entire climactic movement of the poem, that is the trial in Arthur's court, is he going to be acquitted or is he not going to be acquitted? And the speed and thoroughness with which he just abandons all of that. Who cares what happens at the end of the trial? He is out of there and following her to Faerie, right? And that's all that matters. The judgment is a complete side note at that point. I find the ending to Launfal's story really very beautiful. In Sir Orfeo, we see a similar movement too, but it's different. At least it's not, I think, quite where we might expect it. The whole story to that point sounds like the big deal is going to be his final reunion with his wife, right? I mean, the story starts with the fairies taking her away, and then he's really sad, and he goes, and he finds her, and he gets her back from the fairy king. And this is, again, coming back to the discussion we had about that a while ago, this strange kind of silence about the reunion with Herodias, which we would have expected to be the big deal. That's where we would expect the trumpets and the soliloquies and everything else, and we don't get it, right? It happens in a line. Where do we get the happy ending? Where do we get that sudden turn, that sudden wondrous revelation?
When his steward turns out to be completely loyal and, you know, awesome.
Yeah. The happy ending comes when the steward throws himself at Orfeo's feet, right? And I think that's a really kind of interesting thing. That's the moment where the happy ending is placed, where that sort of unexpected rush occurs. Here in talking about these happy endings, I want to read a little bit. This is from J.R.R. Tolkien's On Fairy Stories. His terminology describing this is the best that I know of. It's the only that I know of. Tolkien talks in that essay about the consolation of the happy ending. He says, "Almost I would venture to assert that all complete fairy stories must have it. At least I would say that as tragedy is the true form of drama, its highest function." But the opposite is true of fairy story. Since we do not appear to possess a word that expresses this opposite, that is the opposite of tragedy, comedy is not the opposite of tragedy. It's just a very different thing from tragedy. He says, since we do not appear to possess a word that expresses this opposite, I will call it eucatastrophe. The eucatastrophic tale is the true form of fairy tale and its highest function. The consolation of fairy stories, the joy of the happy ending, or more correctly, of the good catastrophe, that's a literal translation of eucatastrophe, the word he's just made up, the sudden joyous turn, for there is no true end to any fairy tale, This joy, which is one of the things which fairy stories can produce supremely well, is not essentially escapist nor fugitive. In its fairy tale or other world setting, it is a sudden and miraculous grace, never to be counted on to recur. That's his description. It serves both as a description of this subset of happy ending that we see in fairy tales, and that I think that we can see in all four of the ones that we've read so far, this eucatastrophic turn that happens at the end. And I would point to Tolkien's theory here, that this is an essential aspect of fairy story. Not that he's saying that, you know, if it doesn't have this, it's not a legit fairy story, it needs to be thrown out. But he says it is the high, just as you can have other kinds of drama besides tragedy. But he argues tragedy is sort of the ultimate, the highest function of drama. So the eucatastrophic ending is the highest function of fairy stories. Keep this in mind when we get to the end of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is possibly the most famous fairy story in the English literary tradition. It is one of the great works of medieval literature. Its author, who was a brilliant and remarkable poet, we have no idea who he was. He seems to have written three other poems. That is, in the one solitary manuscript in which this poem survives, there are also three other poems, which sound like they were probably written by the same person. They have many of the same techniques. All three of the other poems in that collection, by the way, are Christian poems. That is, very explicitly on Christian themes. Two are sort of virtue poems. That is, one is called Cleanness, Cleanness, and the other is called Patience. Patience, and both of them consist entirely or almost entirely of retellings of Bible stories in verse. Patience is the story of Jonah, which, if you've read Jonah, you might perhaps not expect. And Cleanness is sort of a pastiche of several. I mean, he's talking about cleanness, that is sort of moral purity, is what he means by that, it seems. And he does several stories. The story of Belshazzar's impious feast, that is the story from Daniel with the handwriting on the wall, which Daniel interprets, that Belshazzar being a bad example, a counterexample of moral purity. And then the third other poem is Pearl, which I think is one of the most exquisitely crafted poems I've ever read in the English language in any period. It is unbelievable. He manages both alliteration and rhyme, as well as a really complex stanza structure and a really precise pattern of stanzas within the overall poem. If you're into poetic structure, read Pearl. Short of Dante, I know no poetry more remarkably crafted than Pearl. Pearl is a poem about the mourning of a father whose daughter has died. He falls asleep at her graveside, where he has come to weep again. And he has a vision in his sleep, and in his vision he sees her on the other side of her. There's a river flowing between them, and he meets his young daughter, with whom he has a long conversation, and she tells him certain things that it were good for him to know. It's a remarkable thing. And then also Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which, you know, I tell you this in part because I think you should know, but also because I think sometimes Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is much more famous than the other three poems written by this dude. And I use the word dude generically. We don't have any idea who this person was. Could be male or female, probably male, but that's just a stereotypical guess. We have no idea. The fact that Pearl is told from the father's perspective does kind of suggest a masculine author, but I don't think we must read that autobiographically, so I wouldn't like stick to that absolutely. Anyway, sometimes people will read this manuscript and come to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and say, okay, now for something completely different. I'm not sure, actually, at the end of the day, it's completely different from the other poems, but Before we dig into Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in earnest, however, I want to talk about the translation. And not just about the translation, but about your reading of the book that I have assigned. The reason, about 85% of the reason that I have assigned you this book, is that it has the Middle English on the left page and the modern translation on the right-hand page. The reason I've not given you this poem just in Middle English, as I did the first four poems, is that it's hard. The Gawain poet wrote in a very different dialect, a more, rustic dialect. It's much harder, Middle English, than any of the things that we've read previous to this. And I actually think it not quite fair. You know, I say in my intro to Middle English, the key to reading Middle English is just don't be intimidated. It's not as hard as it looks. This is pretty hard. I'm not going to lie. So I thought it would be a little unkind and a little pointless just to kind of set you off to sea with this. But, now here comes the big but, I want to be talking about the Middle English poem. I still want the Middle English poem to be the thing that you are primarily reading, okay? And what our discussion will primarily be about. I like the fact that you have a modern English translation on the side, which should, I hope, help. Even if it does not always help on a word-for-word basis, that is, if you're looking at the Middle English and you say, I don't understand what that word is at all, and you look over to the right-hand side, well, the line over there might not help you know exactly what that word is because he's gone in a different direction with that line. So it's not always going to help in that way, in the way that, your marginal notes will in the Chaucer edition or whatever. But it still will help you get the sense so that you're at least, even if you remain perhaps unenlightened about the particular word, you will still be able to kind of get the sense of what's going on. It will at least allow you to continue without just sort of being completely confused. Now, what this means is there are, several options of how you read this book when you're holding it in your hand, right? One would be the path of least resistance, that is, hey, look, modern English, right? I can just read the book like this. That's pretty cool, right? I don't have to look over here at all. And it goes by really fast because I'm only reading every other page. Don't do that. Don't do that. And the reason I want you not to do that is that I'm not, or at least I hope I am not, at least I'm going very firmly to attempt not to be simply all snobbish and snooty about the translation and be like, oh, this modern thing is just, oh, it is not quite the thing compared to the medieval poem. I'm going to try not to do that. The moral of the story is that a translation is, it's a different story that he's telling. A translator is not a slave. I mean, they're not at least if they're any good at all, a translator is a storyteller, not an online translation engine to just kind of take the words and the lines and attempt mechanically to give you modern English equivalents of them. No translator does that. No translator should do that. What would be the point? Just write notes then, if that's what you're trying to do. A translator is doing a different thing. As a Tolkien person, I've talked a lot about the Tolkien films. People are always asking me about the Peter Jackson films. And the thing that I've said many times, and I'm sure will continue to say hundreds of more times before I die, is that one has to remember that a film adaptation of a book is a different story from the book. You cannot, you should not, it's silly to expect the book on screen. And if there's something on screen which is different from the book, either because it's added or subtracted, that therefore it is incorrect. Because when you check it by the book, you can see the errors that have been made. I really sympathize with this perspective from people who love books and see movies that are made based on books. Like, I can completely say, and goodness knows, especially when I was in high school, I was probably the most insufferable purist that I've ever met. But I'm really glad the Tolkien films didn't come out then. I would have been a complete disaster, I'm sure. Even more insufferable than I doubtless was already. But again, they're different stories, right? Peter Jackson is not telling Tolkien stories. He's telling his own story. It is based on Tolkien's story. We can see some interesting similarities and differences. Many of the characters are kind of similar. And it's fine. That's a different story. It's a different telling. Just as when you read medieval literature, you see people love to retell stories. The story of the Trojan War is told lots and lots and lots of times. And you know what? That's okay. And you know, somebody's version is not wrong. Like when Ovid is describing the Trojan War and does it very differently from Homer, and we see very different characters acting in very different ways, Ovid isn't getting Homer wrong. He's just telling a different story, right? And it's interesting to look at both of them. The problem is we might not think in the same way about a translation, but I want to encourage you to think in exactly that same way. It's not as extreme as with a translation from book to film, but it's still, I would say, a very similar kind of process. This Simon Armitage is telling a story which is related, and related very closely, to the original Middle English story, but it isn't the same story. He must make choices. Every time he translates a word, he must make choices between different possible meanings and sub-meanings of the Middle English words. And he's got to make his make sense, you know, so that one can read it from beginning to end, and it will work as a story and be interesting. And there are certain stories that he wants to tell. Again, that's perfectly fine, absolutely okay. And I like Simon Armitage's poem. I think it's cool. I think it sounds nice. I think he tells a good story. I think it's fine. But it isn't the same story as the medieval story, and it's the medieval one that I want to be focusing on and talking about in this class. Let me give a little illustration of what I'm talking about in less sort of abstract terms about this sort of translation or this difference in story. Look at page 34. This is the court, Arthur's court's reaction to the Green Knight. And I'm going to start on the very last line on this page, line 237. All studied that there stood and stalked him nere, with all the wonder of the world, what he work shoulder. For fell sellies had they seen, but such never are. For the for fountum and fiery the folk there hit dame it. Okay, so if we look at the Middle English, what is the Middle English saying? They're all staring. They're all amazed, right? Arthur's court are all amazed, and they're coming near him, which is interesting, right? They're amazed not in a "I'm backing away in terror" sense, but in a "I'm creeping together to get a closer look at this thing" sense, right? They're stalking him nearer. They'd seen many fell sellies. They'd seen many strange things before, but such never are. But never such as this before. Ara means before, ever. So what do they conclude? For thee, for fountum and fiery, the folk there hit dame it. They have a quick diagnosis of this. Huge, entirely green guy. Very richly dressed with jewels and ribbons and things. Okay, they say, all right, two quick responses here. One of two things, probably. What is it?
Ghost fairy.
Fountum or fiery? And fountum, I think, is not ghost in our modern sense. Not ghost in the sense of spirit of dead person, necessarily. But like illusion. Right? This is a vision of some kind. Probably conjured by fiery, by magic. And not just magic, fiery. Fairy magic. Remember, that's the same word used, it seems, in a similar sense to what we saw in Sir Orfeo. Remember when Herodotus was taken away, be fiery? Right? By fairy, by magic. This is their response. Now look at Armitage's translation. Some stood and stared, then stepped a little closer, drawn near to the knight to know his next move. They'd seen some sights, but this was something special, a miracle or magic, or so they imagined. Now, he's clearly talking about the same thing. I like the translation. I think it's good. I really enjoy Armitage's alliteration. I think he does a great job with it. It reads really well, and it works really well aloud, too. It's wonderful to listen to read aloud. It's great. But look what he does with their reaction, with their diagnosis, rather. There are two major differences I would point to there in line 240. A miracle or magic, or so they imagined. Magic, all right, yeah. Miracle? What's happened here?
He adapted it so that we would be able to understand a modern context, because if he translated it as phantom, we'd think, oh, it's somebody's ghost.
Right, good. Yeah, phantom does mean something different in the modern world. The word fairy used in this way, he couldn't use at all. I mean, it wouldn't even make sense grammatically to modern people who think of the word fairy only as a noun referring to that kind of being, usually looking like Tinkerbell, right? So, I mean, if they said, it would be nonsense, I think. It would be a couple different levels of nonsense to say, oh, it's fairy. Grammatically, that wouldn't even seem to parse, I think, to a modern person. So sure, he can't just use that word. And miracle, he seems to be using, at least I think he's using, in the fairly generic modern sense of, like, something supernatural, something above the order of the normal is going on here, right? Not necessarily miracle in the theological sense, which is very different from fairy.
I also feel like miracle has a like good or virtuous meaning. So like it's a big angel that's handing out praise for sins or something.
Right. Yeah, even if we don't think about it in a strictly theological sense, like, ah, this is a wonder performed by God, yet you're right, there's still, even when modern people use the word miracle in a pretty generic sense to mean something extraordinary, and so it's still usually good. I mean, nobody uses the word miracle of a bad thing, right? So I agree, it does change the force of it. Arthur's court is not at all certain about this guy, right? I mean, he certainly looks pretty dangerous and could be, and you know, if he is, their first thought, this clearly, like, you know, immediately they're all like, fairy, right? But if he's not a fairy, he could be easily at least a demon at least as well as an angel. So we're not at all certain about this at all. Whereas I agree, miracle does give it a much more positive spin. But even notice the end of the line, or so they imagined. What does the Middle English say? Jordan?
The folk there is demon, which means, okay, they made a decision, they're deeming it a temptum of fairy.
Yeah, they're not imagining anything. So they judged. They've judged this, and a rational judgment it is under the circumstances. Mac, what were you going to say? Okay, good. Yeah, so now, all right. We might say, okay, perhaps we're making too much of this. Okay, sure, he did, you know, again, he's got good reason to not just say fairy exactly as it says. You know, maybe, but maybe, I, you know, we'd be making too much of it to say, well, see, he seems to be downplaying the fairy element in the story. I mean, look, you know, he was alliterating on M's, you know, he had magic, he needed another M, miracle works, that makes sense. You know, imagined, too, he's also alliterating on the M there. So maybe it's just, you know, I mean, hey, you write an alliterative poem if you've got a problem with it, right? That's pretty hard to do. So, all right, you know, maybe it's just a coincidence. I don't think so, actually. Go back to the introduction. Page 11. This is Armitage's introduction. Near the bottom of the page, third to last line, he says, "The poem is also a ghost story, a thriller, a romance, an adventure story, and a morality tale." A ghost story? wait a second, what sense is it that ghosts are? Now I'm like, okay, well, maybe he means that kind of generically, like something eerie and spooky. Though I would still say a ghost story is a very different genre from a fairy story. I mean, we're going in a totally different direction if you're thinking in terms of ghost story. But again, like, you know, whatever, he's making a list. Maybe he's just kind of tossing that off, eerie, spooky, whatever. But he goes back to it in the next page. Let's see, about half of the way down that paragraph there. The knight who throws down the challenge at Camelot is both ghostly and real. Supernatural, yes, but also flesh and blood. He is something in the likeness of ourselves. And he is not purple or orange or blue with yellow stripes. He's green. You see, it's the significance of the greenness we're getting at here. Gawain must negotiate a deal with a man who wears the colors of the leaves and the fields. He must strike an honest bargain with this manifestation of nature, and his future depends on it. Now, there are fine reasons for associating the Green Knight with nature. Like, I mean, we'll look at that, and that's, I think, perfectly viable. But notice what he's doing, a similar thing here in this introduction. First of all, he used the word ghostly again, making me think it wasn't just an accidental thing, that he is thinking of this more as a ghostly kind of supernatural thing, which, again, is very different from fairy story. And to me, fairies are really conspicuously absent in this paragraph. He is something in the likeness of ourselves. Fairies, for instance, but never goes there. Instead, he wants to talk about manifestations of nature, and we want to do like a symbolic thing, which again, like whatever, that may work, that may be cool. I merely posit we can see from his introduction as well, he never mentions fairy or fairy tales or fairy stories once in this entire introduction. He does not seem, if we can judge by this introduction and then also by his translation itself, to really think about the story in these terms at all. I couldn't help but, and he's not like saying this himself, he was quoting other people, talking about scholars who claim to have found exactly like the real castle that Sir Gawain goes to. I'm like, it's in fairy, dude. I mean, you're not. Keep looking. You're not gonna find it. I mean, well, whatever. But anyway, so it seems. I mean, my conclusion on reading his introduction is just that's simply not how he's thinking of this story. Now, again, that's perfectly fine. You can think of the story in different ways. But remember, this is all an illustration of my overall point. The modern English translation is a different story from the original one, and I want to be looking at the original one. Yeah, Jordan?
I think it goes a little bit further than that. The bit about the ghost story, the next sentence is, for want of a better word, it is also a myth, which is pretty scornful of the whole concept of mythology, in my opinion. I think he's showing up. I originally thought there was a slight sense of this, I'm now convinced it's pretty overwhelming. he's a victim of modern bias against fairy tales. Considering how he views a child as a false theory, so he calls it a ghost, which is somehow more adult. I mean,
yeah.
I
think it's more okay for ghosts.
For adults to be
ghosts.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Shakespeare has fairies too, so that could work either way. Yeah, Mac?
Moreover, he's misusing the word myth.
Well,
this isn't a myth in the technical sense, even a little bit.
No, I mean, there are different technical senses. I mean, of course, the way that most people use the word myth is just to mean a thing which is untrue.
Most of these words sublime mean pretty cool, so we can't
use. Right, yeah, exactly. There's the really colloquial and exceptionally limiting use of the word myth, which, again, I'm willing to dismiss. Then there's the higher use of the word myth in the sense of, like, it is a myth, like, a religious story, essentially, is how the word myth is sometimes used there. Like, when we're talking about the mythologies of ancient people, we're referring to a particular subset of their stories.
The way I've always heard myth defined as opposed to the legendary and all those other synonyms is that a myth has to explain how something came to be the way it is.
Sure. Yeah, that's certainly a trend that we see in these ancient mythologies, right? A mythology taken, you know, as a collective is a way that this group of people explained the world, right? So yeah, so you can see myths working in that way. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis talked about myth in a broader sense, in a different sense anyway. I kind of agree, Jordan. I don't even really know what he means when he uses the word myth there. And I also don't know what Armitage would say if you asked him, why don't you ever talk about fairies? You know, the poem you translated does. Fairy story is an obvious genre that you could point to. Why don't you, exactly? And I'm not sure. I'm not sure if he thought about it and rejected it for fear of, you know, what, or if it never even occurred to him. That also seems to me actually kind of possible. I don't know. But we're not here to put Simon Armitage on the couch, so I don't know that we need to speculate too much about it, but yeah.
Actually, it's kind of interesting because you could also say because he's translating it into a modern context, he's trying to make it more fitting for a general audience to read. A general audience really thinks of fairy tales as children's stories, so in that sense, he could just be avoiding saying it because he wants to get them the proper picture.
Yeah, yeah. Think about it as children's stories, if they think about it at all. No, I mean, I agree. I wouldn't necessarily criticize him for this idea. He's certainly right that, well, if this is what he's doing or saying, he would certainly be right to think that modern audiences would have a particular reaction, which I'm suspecting he would find undesirable. And what's more, it would seem strange. I mean, if you said, okay, people, are you ready for a fairy tale? Then even those people who were interested in such a thing would read this and be like, not what I was expecting when I sat down to read a fairy tale. Anyway. The conclusion is the left side of the page. Keep your eyes on the left side of the page, permitting yourself the occasional decorous glance to the right-hand side of the page. And it's okay to read it, but but left side of the page is our chief concern. Now, I want to draw brief attention to the very opening of the poem. This is something that would send some very clear cues to a medieval audience. It might seem odd at first that the story begins with the burning of Troy. It's like, why do we care about Troy? What does that have to do with anything? What it does is establishes a context. This is, first of all, let me emphasize, a historical context. Medieval English people seem to believe in the historical, they believe in the historical existence of the Trojan War. They didn't necessarily buy every detail of every story, but they certainly believe the Trojan War happened, more or less like it was described. All of the events that he describes are history, and more than just history, these things are English history. English history because they tell the progression of English empire. You have Troy. Troy was the great city. Troy fell. But Troy survived because Aeneas leaves Troy and takes with him the tradition of Troy. And where do he and his descendants end up? Rome. And Rome grows from the ashes of Troy. So what Troy was, now Rome has become. It is the next step in this, what the Latin phrase that was used in the Middle Ages, the translatio imperii, the translation of empire, from Troy now to Rome. And then from Rome, a descendant of Romulus, we get Felix Brutus. Fortunate, happy Brutus, right? Brutus, who comes to England and founds the land, and that's why it's called Bruton, sort of. Seriously, that's where they said the name Britain eventually comes from, was from Brutus. It's fine. And anyway, so he's the founder of Britain. He is the Aeneas of the British. So then England rises from the ashes of Rome, you see. And we get King Arthur and King Arthur's court. So King Arthur's court. So the very clear line that gets drawn, and this is not news to anybody. This is tradition that we medieval English people all know. Troy, Rome, Arthur's court. Now, let's go to Arthur's court. So, you know, we've had some implications through the other Arthurian romances that we've been reading that this is, you know, Arthur's court is the greatest human court. Here we get explicit historical cues. Remember the function of Arthur's court in this ancient and historical tradition. We are prompted to be thinking of Arthur and his court as this culmination, almost, of human history. Certainly this great tradition and inheritance. Therefore, this is what's behind, say, the mockery of the Green Knight. This is why he talks the way that he does. If you look at line 309, for instance, this is when you know, he makes his challenge and nobody answers him. On page 40. "What, is this Arthur's horse?" quoth the Hathelvenna, "that all the Rus Rennes of Thorhrealm so money? What, is this Arthur's house?" "The great, legendary Arthur's house. Everybody has heard of you and your fame. You're the greatest anywhere, right? Troy, Rome, Arthur." "I'm a little disappointed. I find myself underwhelmed by the great Arthur's court," right? That's the force of what he's evoking there. Another thing that I would just want briefly to contextualize, Arthur's tradition, which we see in other places as well, of not starting a feast until a marvel happens. When there's a great feast, he will frequently hang out and wait until something cool happens, and then everybody can eat. Because this happens in many different ways, on many different occasions. Usually marvels oblige him on these high feasts. Although when he talks about it here, it's a little bit interesting. He also says he seems to open the possibility of hearing tales. That is, have somebody relate a story. So it's not just let's sit banking on the fact that, you know, something marvelous, something magical is going to happen, you know, in the next couple hours before we all get really, really, really hungry and the food gets cold. But he also says, you know, that someone devise me, you know, a tale that something. But he insists something that's true. He's not interested in fiction here. This is page 26. We're told on line 91 that he thurch nobile had nomen that he wold never ate upon such a dare die ere him devised were of some aventurous thing, an uncouth tale, of some mine marvile, that he micht trawa, of alderes, of armes, of other aventures, other some sedge him besocht, of some sicker knicht, to join with him in justing, in jeopardy to lie, laid leaf for leaf, lave uch on other, as fortune would falsen home, the fire to have. So there are lots of options here that he would accept. He be told about some adventurous thing, some uncouth tale. Uncouth means unknown, strange, new to him, tale. Of some mine marvaila, some marvelous feat. That he mich trawa, notice, that he might believe in. Not fiction. I hate to pick on Armitage. I keep saying, like, it's cool. And it is. Totally fine. But notice again what Armitage does with this. Some far-fetched yarn or outrageous fable, the tallest of tales, yet one ringing with truth. The tallest of tales? No. I mean, okay, ringing with truth, like he does sort of recognize. But no, it has to be a real thing, something he can believe in. Yes, it's supposed to be marvelous. But not a fable. No. No, not quite. Again, but see, that's... So the Green Knight is... This is the perfect solution. Huge green fellow comes into the court. And Arthur jokes about this afterwards, right? He's just picked up his head and ridden out and, like, you know, his dismembered head has defied, you know, Gawain to come and cut off his head in a year. And, you know, he weaves and there's, like, this awkward silence, right? And Arthur's like, so, guess we can eat now? Right? It's a really fantastic moment. We actually see Arthur, and we're told that Arthur is, like, self-consciously yucking it up in order to smooth over the moment, especially for Guinevere. He's a little afraid Guinevere's going to freak out here. So, you know, he's like, you know, so he starts, you know, like, joking with Gawain, and you've hewed enough, Gawain, har, 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 put that axe away, and let's eat. So this certainly works. It certainly counts. What stuff do you notice? When the Green Knight comes in, the grand entrance of which we get a long description of the Green Knight, what do you notice? What kind of cues do we get there? Well,
he's not wearing shoes. His spurs are his extra stuff.
Yes, he is not wearing shoes. I have no idea what to do with that. I'll just be honest with you.
To be connected to the earth from which he comes. Ooh. So he can't wear shoes.
Ooh, I like that. I like that.
He's not barefoot.
Yeah, he's wearing socks.
Well, he was fucking gross.
It's kind of gross.
They're really muddy. He wants to be close to the earth.
Wait. He wants to be close to the earth, but he thinks that being muddy is gross? That's the problem? Right, he's green. Right.
Maybe he doesn't want to be close to you. He just wants to be kind of near it.
Right. Not an
maybe
actual
point. Maybe everybody else.
What's the most honest relationship?
Maybe if they don't make shoes big enough for him.
Now that is plausible. Yes. They were straight out of the, like, size 48 shoes or whatever it is that he wears. How tall is he, by the way?
Really?
15.
Very tall. But no, this is exactly... Are we talking 15 feet tall? You'll notice on the homepage of the Blackboard page, I've put a little version of John Howe's painting of Sir Gawain confronting the Green Knight. This is the scene that happens at the end of the story and not here. John Howe depicts the Green Knight as, like, 20 feet high or so. I don't think that can be right. First of all, Gawain would have needed, like, a stepladder and an axe twice as big as the one to get through that neck. And secondly, he wields the same axe that the Green Knight brings in. And the axe wielded by the Green Knight in that painting has got to be 15 feet high and, like, you know, like an inch in, or like a foot in diameter. I mean, that's not possible.
The wing's just awesome.
Yeah, there's that, I guess. But no, I don't think he's quite so awesome as that.
I think it's entirely how we think Arthur's glory.
Okay, that's a limiting factor, I agree, though that could be pretty big, so, you know, I'm not sure how limiting that is. He's described as, it looks like he's half an Ettin. He looks like a half giant. Not a whole giant. 15 feet would be like a whole giant, I think. But we're like demi-Ettin mode here, not full Ettin size.
Going back to the clothes thing, I think something that was really important that was in here was that he has no helmet and no hauberk.
Yes, hauberk. Yeah, which means just armor. He's not wearing armor, and he's not. That's the one thing that I can think of that is sensible to do with the shoes or the shoelessness of the Green Knight. It's sort of an even more sort of extreme touch of Marta, exactly what you're pointing to. He's totally not armed for war. He's dressed nicely, but it's in... Well, I mean, you remember Arthur was in Graena when he was caught out in the woods by Sir Gromer Somerjour and not armed. He was in green, that is, he was hunting. He wasn't in as much green, of course, but anyway, he was still in hunting clothes. And I wonder if the shoelessness is sort of involved with that, too. It's like, hey, look... Not even wearing boots, you know. I'm, like, completely unprotected.
other than just by, you know, my nice clothes and my gold, of which he has plenty, and gems, green ones, of course. Yes, I mean, we definitely see that. He's described as a head higher and more than the tallest person in Arthur's court. So I mean, given that and the half-Eton thing, I'd put him at, like, no more than, like, 7'6", probably. I mean, he's huge, but, like, just above man stature, I would say. Again, he's literally head and shoulders above everybody else. But it's not like Arthur's knights all come up to his navel or something. He's noticeable. Even if he weren't bright green, he would be noticeable in a crowd. But of course, with the greenness, he's very noticeable. Will?
They don't say anything about his horse being pretty cool.
Right. Yeah, his horse would be pretty crazy. If you think it's weird for him to ride his horse straight into Arthur's hall and up to the feasting table, it's not. We do this all the time in the Middle Ages. You don't need to take your shoes off. You don't even dismount. Just ride on in to the court. I mean, there's a really funny moment. It's designed to be a really funny moment, but there's a really funny moment in Chretien's Percival when Percival rides his horse straight into Arthur's court, and he accidentally, like, when he tries to turn his horse to go out, his horse, like, knocks Arthur's hat off, and, like, hilarity ensues. But anyway, it's like perfectly normal to ride your horse into the court. So I know that's even funnier for the people who took Arthurian lit, because Percival is really hilarious. But fun memories of Percival the idiot riding his horse into Arthur's court. But not an idiot, the immensely, almost indescribably naive and simple-minded Percival. Anyhow, I should probably actually let you go, but we will resume with the Green Knight and look at his little Christmas game that he would like to play with, you know, whoever.
Okay, for next time, read the second fit of the poem. Make sure to pay special attention to the description of Gawain's shield, especially to the passage discussing his connection with the number 5. Really, it's important. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.